It's called presidential harassment.
I want nothing.
And it's unfortunate.
I want no quid pro quo.
This should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly. He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney. Yeah, sure.
Shut up, Rudy.
Okay, hold on.
Shut up.
Hold on.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What they've done to General Flynn.
Russia.
What they've done to others.
It was all bull.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney, and former federal prosecutor. Ken blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So it's been a big time for Simon & Schuster lately. It's not just the John Bolton book. Mary Trump, the president's niece, has a tell-all book that's supposed to be published later this summer, also by Simon & Schuster. The president does not want it published, and he says Mary Trump signed a non-disclosure agreement as part of a settlement over the estate of Fred Trump. Fred was the president's father and was Mary Trump's grandfather. So the president's brother, Robert Trump, has been suing, trying to block the publication of this book, and a trial judge in New York granted a temporary restraining order, saying the book can't be published before he holds a hearing on Robert Trump's request for an injunction against publication. Attorneys for Simon & Schuster will appeal the temporary restraining order to a New York appellate court. So, Ken, suppose for a moment that Mary Trump really is bound by a non-disclosure agreement here. What sort of relief would you expect a court to provide? Would they actually enjoin the publication of this book, or would it just be that the Trumps are entitled to damages from Mary because she violated the agreement?
Generally, you would only expect damages. So prohibiting the publication of the book in advance is called prior restraint, and it's one of the most comprehensively prohibited legal moves in the law. All the cases indicate that there is a very heavy presumption against it. It's extremely hard, if not impossible, to get an order prohibiting pre-publication, even when it's something like the Pentagon Papers, something that the government is jumping up and down and saying that it implicates national security. So there are a couple of reasons that it's very unlikely that this order is going to stick. One is that it doesn't just bind Mary Trump. She's the one who allegedly signed this confidentiality agreement 20 years ago in the course of negotiations over Fred Trump's estate. But it also purports to bind Simon & Schuster, a third party who was not part of that confidentiality agreement. And generally, American courts don't agree that you can bind a third party like that and prohibit them from publishing just because the person who gave them the information allegedly violated an agreement or broke the law. Again, that's the whole point of the Pentagon Papers case, that it didn't matter that whoever got the Pentagon Papers got it by skullduggery and violated the law, the papers could still be published. Similarly here, it's very questionable that Simon & Schuster can be prohibited from publishing this book just on the theory that Mary Trump wasn't supposed to write it. So this is a situation where a trial judge has issued a temporary restraining order just until the parties brief the matter fully. It's very unusual to have a more permanent prior restraint order than that. Often, judges realize they screwed up after they issue the TRO and don't issue a preliminary injunction and dissolve the order. I expect that one of two things will happen. Either this judge will change his mind and not issue a preliminary injunction, having just slowed things down for 10 days or so, or a New York appellate court will dissolve the order. Because again, this is a unprecedented type of order that the Trumps are seeking here. And it would be really unprecedented and historical for a book like this to be prohibited to be published.
There are some issues here that are similar to the ones that we were talking about recently with John Bolton's book, where the U.S. government sued trying to get an order to stop John Bolton from sharing certain information. They didn't actually name Simon & Schuster in that lawsuit, but they tried to get an order sort of as an end run, basically saying that Bolton had to instruct his various agents to also abide by this order, and to the extent that he had the authority to force them to do so, that he had to do that. And so I guess, you know, in the Pentagon Papers case, the newspapers were not an agent of whoever had provided those papers to them. The paper had a source, but they didn't have a traditional business relationship as such. Here, in this case, I mean, could an obligation that binds Mary Trump be binding on someone who has a business relationship with her, acting as her agent, putting the information out there? Do they not have any obligation to abide by whatever agreements that Mary Trump has entered into that they are aware of?
Well, that's the Trump argument. But as Simon & Schuster's lawyers and the lawyers for all the amicus parties that have weighed in now have pointed out, it's a bad argument. A publisher is not the agent of a writer. The writer's agent is their agent. The publisher is in an arm's length contract with them, paying them for services. That's not agency. They're not acting on behalf of the writer. They've entered into an agreement with the writer. So, and an idea that a publisher is an agent of the source of information would be an end run around the prior restraint doctrine and basically allow anyone to prohibit any third party from publishing on the theory that they're now in cahoots with the source of information. The argument that the injunction should just also generally broadly encompass anyone acting in concert with Mary Trump is also a problem. And it's the one that was rejected by the judge in the Bolton case, because again, it's an end run around traditional rules under the First Amendment prohibiting prior restraint. If you can just say, well, we can't directly enjoin a publisher, but we can enjoin them because they know about the injunction, then the doctrine doesn't have any meaning. So those are both arguments that while Charles Harder is making them very vociferously on behalf of the Trumps, they're not very good arguments.
Why is Donald Trump's brother bringing this lawsuit rather than Donald Trump himself bringing the lawsuit?
Well, Donald Trump's brother is nominally bringing the lawsuit. I mean, it's Charles Harder who has repeatedly represented Trump in legal threats against publishers and the occasional suit, and he just so happens to be the one who's now representing Trump's brother. So it seems to me that Trump's brother is pretty clearly just a figurehead here for the interests of the president. There's no indication of why Trump's brother would be particularly wounded by the release of this information, as opposed to the president having unflattering things about him put out just before an election.
Right, but that's the thing. I mean, presumably, if this lawsuit proceeded to its conclusion and they were seeking damages from Mary Trump, whatever damages Robert Trump has would presumably pale in comparison to the damages that Donald Trump would have. So would Robert Trump need to demonstrate his own damages? Can he sue and can they then seek damages based on damage to President Trump's reputation? And does having Robert Trump sort of serve as a stand-in for Donald Trump, does that protect Donald Trump at all? Does that make it harder, for example, to depose Donald Trump or seek records from him as part of this lawsuit because he is technically not a party to it?
All good questions. So yes, it would have to be Robert Trump's damages that are sought. He can't seek damages on behalf of Donald Trump. And it's not clear that embarrassment is the sort of damage that you could recover for in this circumstance anyway. But I'm not sure that recovering money is really the point here. The point is to harass and oppose and attempt to thwart publication of something unflattering to the president. The point is performative litigation to show vigorousness and strength and how we're standing up to the liberals and standing up to the media elite and that type of thing. And the use of Robert in the place of Trump is just, you know, a very thin veneer that's not going to convince anyone who is not already pre-convinced that this is legitimate. So I think, yes, it might make it a hair easier for Donald Trump to avoid discovery process, because after all, if he were claiming damages, he would definitely have to be deposed. But again, I don't know that anyone intends for this to go as far as discovery, as opposed to just inflict consequences on people for criticizing the president through abuse of the legal system, and to possibly even thwart publication of the book, at least for a while.
Does the enforceability of a nondisclosure agreement depend upon the nature of the information that's being protected? I ask that because before Mary Trump wrote this book, which was ghostwritten by a former New York Times reporter, she was a key source for a New York Times story about the Trump family finances. And one of the key allegations in that story was that the Trumps had committed certain kinds of tax fraud. Can you enforce a nondisclosure agreement to prevent somebody from disclosing the fact that a crime was committed or from disclosing an allegation that a crime was committed? Are there any public policy limitations on what you can use an NDA to hide?
There are. So in general, a non-disclosure or confidentiality or non-disparagement agreement that purports to prohibit you from going to the police, from reporting misconduct to the authorities, is unenforceable because it violates public policy. And even though you see people trying to get away with it, generally you're not going to be successful in enforcing one to the extent it prohibits you from going to the cops to report something wrong. Going to the media is a different matter. So it's not as clear that an agreement that prohibits going to the media to report bad things is going to be unenforceable. There's an argument that it's against public policy. And indeed, you might remember that Michael Avenatti brought that argument on behalf of Stormy Daniels in the case of the hush money payment, that the confidentiality agreement there should be void as against public policy because it prevented information about a presidential candidate from coming out. But that's not a terribly strong argument. The authority for the proposition that you can't prevent someone from dishing dirt to the media is not very strong. The authority for the proposition you can't prevent them from going to the cops is very strong.
Roger Stone was supposed to report to prison by June 30. We are recording this show on July 1, and Roger Stone is not in prison yet. He had asked long-suffering federal judge Amy Berman Jackson to delay his prison reporting date for 2 months because of the risk of coronavirus. The government didn't oppose his request to delay it. Jackson agreed to delay his surrender date, but only by 2 weeks, and she did it with a spin. She noted that there are no apparent coronavirus cases at the facility Stone has been assigned to, but that Stone himself resides in Broward County, Florida, where there's been a spike in cases. So there's risk that he will bring coronavirus to the prison. So Judge Jackson ordered him to stay confined to his home for 2 weeks before reporting to prison as a sort of quarantine, noting that, quote, this will address the defendant's stated medical concerns during the current increase of reported cases in Florida, unquote. So, Ken, this sets a new deadline for us in terms of when the president would actually have to pardon Roger Stone to stop him from having to go to prison. It's July 14th.
Yes, and this order and the whole process from Judge Berman Jackson is remarkable. It really conveys, blatant contempt and disgust at the actions of the government. From the start, when Stone asked for this break to have his surrender be delayed and the government said okay, the judge started saying, well, wait a minute, you're saying okay, why is that? Do you say that to other people? And the government came back with a very unconvincing brief saying, oh, we're just applying the same principles we apply to all defendants. Judge Jackson's order here, giving Stone another 14 days but not granting the full relief, makes it pretty clear that she's calling the government a liar here. There's a delightful line that you pointed out, Josh, where she snidely says she certainly looks forward to this lenient rule being applied across the board to other defendants, conveying, of course, that she expects it won't be applied to other defendants. She's just as brutal to Stone, pointing out that his request is based on his physician's advice, but it seems unclear whether he's been abiding by his physician's advice to stay away from people in other circumstances. So she winds up confining him in his home as a condition of 14 more days release, but making him surrender. And yes, you're right. That means that the big decision on the president is going to be within 14 days, unless Attorney General Bill Barr pulls out some way to try to have the conviction overturned or rescinded or some foolishness like that before that date.
But that would be challenging, right? Because he has already been sentenced. Part of why the Justice Department was able to seek to withdraw the charges against Michael Flynn was that he had not been sentenced yet. So isn't this out of the prosecutor's hands for Roger Stone since he's already been sentenced?
It would seem to be, but I don't know that we've completely plumbed the depths of what the Barr Justice Department is willing to do in a situation like this. And it's conceivable that he could have them file some sort of motion to vacate the conviction. I don't think that Judge Berman Jackson would put up with that in the slightest. But it would not surprise me at this point to see some sort of effort by the Justice Department, not just to agree to the request to leave Stone out longer, but to take affirmative steps to undermine his conviction.
But unlike in the Michael Flynn case, and we've been talking about this key legal issue that's before the appellate courts right now about whether Judge Emmett Sullivan really has any discretion to decide whether to grant the government's motion to dismiss the charge against Michael Flynn, in this case, it would be clear that Judge Berman Jackson does not have to simply submit to whatever the government wants there. If they wanted to vacate the conviction, she would have, would she have discretion, or maybe she even wouldn't be able to grant it? I don't know what the law is, but it's certainly not the case that she just has to do whatever the government asks as a matter of prosecutorial discretion.
No question. She would have the deciding role, and it would be an uphill battle for the Justice Department. Now, the question is, if they are so committed to sparing Roger Stone, what method they're most likely to use to do it? The lengths they went to spare Flynn certainly suggests that there's some institutional reluctance by Trump to use the pardon power in a situation like this when that would be the easiest, cleanest way to help somebody out. So I don't know that it's, 2 years ago, I would have said, absolutely not, it'll never happen. Now, I'm not confident that the Justice Department wouldn't try some sort of shenanigan with the Bureau of Prisons or with anyone else to try to spare Stone from having to surrender as ordered by the court.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the Bureau of Prisons, which is also part of the Justice Department. Could they set the conditions of Roger Stone's custody such that he was, for example, being held entirely in home confinement? Presumably, BOP could decide that he doesn't need to go to prison.
They could. They could change his designation, and Barr could force that to happen, theoretically. It would be scandalous, but not more scandalous, in my view, than the things that were done in the Flynn case.
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk about Michael Flynn. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Ken, is Sidney Powell a good lawyer?
Well, there's an old saying that a good lawyer knows the law and a great lawyer knows the judge.
So, in Sidney Powell's case, it's not so much knowing the judge as knowing the attorney general. Sidney Powell, of course, is Michael Flynn's attorney. She's not Michael Flynn's first attorney. He replaced the attorneys who had a more normal approach for someone who was a cooperating witness, as Michael Flynn theoretically was, where you've pleaded guilty to one offense, you're probably not going to get any jail time. You try to move your client through in a way that pisses off the judge as little as possible. Flynn didn't like the results of that, so he switched to this lawyer who took an extremely aggressive approach that greatly irritated Judge Emmett Sullivan, but Sidney Powell seems to have had some success prevailing upon Attorney General Bill Barr to intervene on behalf of her client in some extraordinary ways that appear quite likely to result in the charge to which he had already pleaded guilty being dismissed.
It's true. For a good year while we've been talking about this, we've been assuming that the audience was the president and that the sought-after end result was a pardon. And I don't think many people imagined that the recipient of the message would be the attorney general and that it would be possible to convince the U.S. Department of Justice to take such a obvious dive here as they have. But there's no question that she got it done for her client. So to the extent that's the measure of a good lawyer, she is a good lawyer. I think that a presidential pardon would have been cleaner. Her client is not yet out of the woods. There's still the possibility that the D.C. Circuit will rehear this case and come to a different result. I think that's a strong possibility. But she convinced the Attorney General of the United States to intervene to spare her client despite repeated guilty pleas.
Yeah, I think it's been your view that sooner or later the Justice Department is going to get its way here, that even if the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals says that, no, this three-judge panel was wrong to intervene and demand that Judge Sullivan vacate the charge against Michael Flynn right away, that the government has a strong argument that it's really up to the government to decide whether Flynn should be prosecuted for this even at this late date. So it's likely that this strategy, such as it is going to work. But one thing that we'd been assuming was that a pardon was the backstop, that basically the president was using Bill Barr as his agent to try to find a way to get rid of the charge against Michael Flynn without having to issue the pardon. But I think from some of the stuff we've seen in the news about the way that Sidney Powell made a direct appeal to Bill Barr that appears to have been effective, it makes me wonder if Barr was acting not so much at the president's instruction as that he was doing what he thought probably correctly the president would want him to do. And so that makes me wonder about the president's willingness to backstop this with a pardon in the unlikely event that this doesn't work and that somehow they do proceed to sentencing for Michael Flynn. We still, as with Roger Stone, we've seen the president's severe reluctance to involve himself in the most direct political manner possible by pardoning his associates. He would like to keep them out of prison, but it's not clear the extent to which he's willing to incur direct political damage in order to do so.
Well, I think you're right that we've assumed that for a while that the ultimate result would be Flynn getting off no matter what, because I still don't think that Judge Sullivan, in after he puts on this whole show, is still going to be inclined to basically take over the role of judge and prosecutor to push forward prosecution that the government doesn't want to do. Maybe he'd appoint a special prosecutor or something, but I think ultimately the tension between the judicial and prosecutorial role is too high, and the spectacle of just the judge taking over a prosecution is too much. I do think he would have had a very thorough exposition of why he thought the move was corrupt, which it is. But you may be right. I mean, I think as you've pointed out before, Josh, Trump's pardons have always been often been sort of culture war type maneuvers meant to tweak people and rile up liberals and that type of thing. He has not been as inclined to actually go to bat for people who have helped him. And so far, a number of people who have helped him have continued to suffer the consequences of the criminal justice system without his assistance. So maybe you're right that he's not, for whatever reason, willing to show the loyalty that people have shown him.
If this three-judge panel decision that directed Judge Sullivan to promptly dismiss the charge against Michael Flynn, if that decision is reversed and this process is allowed to proceed, is it conceivable that, you know, even if Sullivan is on a road toward ultimately dismissing this charge, that the process will still be ongoing by the time the next presidential inauguration happens? And if that's the case, if you have a Biden-led administration with a Democratic attorney general and the case is not yet completed, could they come in and change their position again and say, actually, we don't want to dismiss the charge. We want to proceed toward sentencing with Michael Flynn?
Well, first of all, I think that if the D.C. Circuit does not take this up en banc, then it's very likely that Sullivan will have to rule before the election. I don't think it can be delayed out that far in light of an order like this, and I don't think Sullivan's one to openly defy the Court of Appeals the way he would have to. I suppose there could be a petition for cert to the Supreme Court, which might kick things down the road a ways, but I suspect that forces on the Supreme Court would get it denied quickly, and I don't think that would take long enough either. So I think this is going to come to a head one way or the other before the election. To the extent it's still open, then yes, absolutely. Possible Biden administration could reverse all of this. I'm not sure 100% if they would, just because the spectacle of going back and forth on something like this. I don't know if President Biden, the sort of people who would advise a hypothetical President Biden, want to dive into sort of revenge and righting wrongs and spending a lot of their honeymoon period and institutional capital on revisiting all these prosecutions. I think that's kind of the dream of people who hate Trump, but I'm not sure that it would happen. I'm not even sure that it would be politically wise for it to happen.
So Sidney Powell is a good lawyer, at least this week. Is Jay Clayton a good lawyer?
Yes, but the question is, what kind of good lawyer?
Jay Clayton is the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's a mergers and acquisitions lawyer. He decided it might be nice to be U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York because it would give him trial experience, which is sort of like saying that being the CEO of Ford will give you managerial experience. And so as part of this very strange incident that we have discussed, the attempted Friday night massacre, the removal of Jeffrey Berman that did ultimately succeed, although it led to Berman's replacement with a trusted deputy who is likely to continue to run run that office in the same way, which has often irritated Bill Barr and President Trump. Jay Clayton, in theory, might be nominated to become the permanent U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. But obviously now there are significant concerns from Democrats about the possibility that Jay Clayton will act as a political fixer for the president, who had decided to make this very irregular move, putting him in there. The Senate has what's called a blue slip process, where basically the home state senators are supposed to sign off on a U.S. attorney choice. And Lindsey Graham, who chairs the relevant committee in the Senate, said he's not going to move this nomination forward without a blue slip from New York's Democratic senators, which he's not going to get. So I don't think that Jay Clayton is likely to become the U.S. attorney anytime soon. But this is still a really odd thing, right? Like, how often is it the case that somebody who's not a trial lawyer, who is not a criminal lawyer, ends up running one of these U.S. attorney's offices?
It's unusual, but not unheard of. So sometimes there are very blatantly, overtly political appointments. Rarely the one is prominent as a Southern District, but it happens. So as a memorable example, Senator Strom Thurmond's son, who was then, I think, 28 years old and 3 years out of law school, was appointed as the U.S. attorney in South Carolina. So sometimes there are things like that. You know, the job of a U.S. attorney is not a trial lawyer job. A lot of it is politics. A lot of it is, you know, budget. And a lot of it is, you know, relationships with other law enforcement agencies. So someone who is skilled at those things can add value to a U.S. attorney's office. But it is fairly important, if you're going to have someone who is hands-on, to have some sort of understanding of the issues, because there are a number of very important decisions on which the U.S. attorney is required by regulation to weigh in, complex criminal law calls and civil law calls. So it would be unusual, but I mean, weirder things have happened. These positions have been sometimes given away for crass political reasons.
Finally, law YouTuber Devin Stone, known as the Legal Eagle, has filed a number of Freedom of Information Act requests seeking information about the process by which the White House sought to block John Bolton from publishing certain information. Now, this isn't about the lawsuit against John Bolton. This is about the pre-publication review process that came before the lawsuit, where the White House reviews your manuscript and says what you can't publish because it's classified. And the Legal Eagle thinks that that they made pretextual objections, basically, that they said that information was classified not because it was truly important to national security, but because it would be embarrassing to the president or to the administration if it was published. And so, I mean, the first thing I thought about when I saw this is, can you FOIA the National Security Council? I mean, this process, for obvious reasons, is a sensitive one where this stuff has to be conducted in secret in order to avoid the disclosure of classified information. So how can you really just file a FOIA and find out how this stuff works?
Josh, the first question is whether, yes, like you said, whether you can FOIA the National Security Council. And they would say you cannot. It's been their position for a while, as well as some entities sort of connected to the National Security Council. In addition, several courts have said that they are not susceptible to FOIA requests. So I think the Legal Eagle is facing a very much an uphill battle here. And even if the National Security Council were subject to FOIA, there are still a host of FOIA exemptions and exceptions and arguments for non-disclosure that you can expect that they would bring to bear. So I think it's going to be a very difficult uphill battle to get this stuff.
And plausible objections, right? I mean, assuming that the information is classified, then it's obvious why that can't be disclosed pursuant to a Freedom of Information Act request. If the NSC is subject to FOIA, if you are able to file requests of some sort, and if the dispute was over whether the information was properly classified, is that something like the judge would secretly review the information, would make a determination about classification, and if the judge determined that it was not properly classified, then it might be subject to disclosure?
Possibly, but that's way down the road. And frankly, judges tend to defer to the government on issues of what should or should not be classified. It's fairly rare for judges to kind of go out on a limb and disagree with those classifications.
So I think this is probably not a very promising route for us to learn more of the information that John Bolton had hoped to share with the public. There is much more for us to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.